I have the distinct pleasure and honor to introduce our final speaker, who will give some concluding remarks. Ken Weinstein's last job was the assistant to the president for counterterrorism and homeland security at the White House. He was, prior to that, the first head of the National Security Division at the Department of Justice. He is an experienced prosecutor. He was the U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia and my boss. That's where I first met him. And so it's a great honor and privilege to introduce Ken Weinstein.
Thanks, everybody. Good to see you. First want to say, is Kate still here? Okay, Kate, the only reason they had me speak was to make sure you didn't get the last word. So. it's really a pleasure to be here. I want to thank Heritage and Federalist Society for putting this on and for inviting me. I think it's tremendously timely and meaty, and it's an issue, a set of issues that I think benefits from this kind of discussion and good, healthy debate. The topic that I was asked to speak on, and I'll do so relatively briefly, was just, you know, what was laid out in the agenda, which is what legal structures can keep America safe against terrorist attacks. As I said, that's a very timely, this is very timely to be discussing this now because we have this debate sort of playing out on the national stage, but it's also really a timeless issue because as much as we think these are the hot issues of the day, the reality is these issues or some variant of these issues are going to be with us as long as we are dealing with this, dealing with international terrorism. And I think I'd like to take a bit of a historical perspective here to sort of reinforce the idea that to understand the state of where we are with our legal structure, we really have to go back to 9/11 and to the fundamental course correction that is represented by that day. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, we went through a sort of a dizzying array of fundamental changes to our national counterterrorism program. And these changes were the result of a number of things. I think it's important to understand why and how they came about. First, they were a direct result of the devastation of that day, because that devastation really was a very clear reminder of how vulnerable our country was to a determined adversary. Second, they grew out of the recognition that we were dealing with a different kind of adversary in the international terrorists like Al-Qaeda. These terrorists didn't constitute a formal army with the trappings of an organized state military, the type of entity that the rules of war were initially designed for, and nor did they represent the type of threat that is readily addressed by the criminal justice system, a system that is focused on judging and punishing people for completed crimes and not necessarily for preventing crimes from taking place in the first place, which of course is the mission, the preventive mission of counterterrorism. In short, these terrorists posed and still do pose a threat that is somewhere between the war paradigm and the criminal justice paradigm, and that's a paradigm that caused us to question our sort of fundamental preconceived notions of how to dispense justice in the context of international terrorism. And then the final thing to note about the post-9/11 reforms is that they grew out of a recognition that our counterterrorism apparatus was ill-equipped to deal with Al-Qaeda-like terrorist organizations. We woke up on the morning of 9/11 with a counterterrorism apparatus that was limited in size, scope, and authority, that lacked sufficient coordination among its key players, and that was designed in large part to be more reactive than proactive and preventive. And just to make it clear, that wasn't the fault of any single agency or any single administration. To the contrary, the reality is that until 9/11 happened, until we were slapped in the face with 9/11, we just didn't have the public and political will to force the very difficult and fundamental changes that were necessary to build an effective counterterrorism program. It was only after the clarion call of 9/11 that the national will grew and existed to fundamentally reorient the government's efforts toward terrorist prevention. Now, for all these reasons that I just listed, the need for prompt legislative and executive action was manifest in the hours and days after 9/11, and we'd launched into an all-out effort to build up our counterterrorism defenses. Reforms and initiatives were rolled out at a furious rate. Significant pieces of legislation like the Patriot Act were signed into law in relatively short order. And then after a couple years, once the initial threat had sort of subsided or had been perceived to have subsided, and we got through the sort of more frenetic building stage, we as a nation were able to step back, take a breath, and take a hard look at all the new structural, legal, and operational innovations that we'd put in place and evaluate them with calm reflection. In fact, we've been going through that evaluation process for some time now, and as far back as at least 2005 or early 2006, which was the time leading up to the Patriot Act reauthorization, which was a very very thorough debate and analysis or assessment of the Patriot Act, which was a series of what were hastily passed authorities that and the debate was whether or not those had been drafted with sufficient safeguards to protect civil liberties and privacy, and then whether they were implemented with due respect for those values. Now, that debate that played out in the lead in the run-up to the Patriot Act reauthorization has morphed and sort of carried on in various iterations over the last few years, and in the last weeks, last month or so, we've seen a recent version of this debate play out on the national stage. And that debate has been healthy in many ways, but it's also had a sort of an unfortunate side effect, which is that it's created a misimpression in the minds of some that the whole regime of counterterrorism or terrorism prevention that was built after 9/11 is being called into question. But as you all know, that is not the case. While a few policies have generated white-hot controversy and very strong feelings, those particular policies constitute only a small subset of the counterterrorism initiatives and policies and reforms that have been instituted since 9/11. Initiatives and reforms including structural reorganizations like the creation of DHS, the Office of the DNI, and the NCTC, the lowering of the legal wall that had kept our law enforcement intelligence communities from sharing information and coordinating their efforts, the development of new regulatory and legal authorities, including the FISA Amendments Act, the Patriot Act reauthorization, and the recent rewrites of the Attorney General Guidelines for National Security Investigations and Executive Order 12333. And lastly, the fundamental reforms to agencies like the FBI, which in particular has overhauled and sort of reoriented its efforts and operations in order to take its historical facility for investigating completed crimes and applying that facility to the effort to detect and prevent terrorist threats. So that is just a sampling of the comprehensive reforms that have taken place over the last 8 years, and together they represent a sea change in the manner in which we pursue counterterrorism. And the real debate today is whether the executive and the legislative branches will now undertake to solidify and institutionalize the policies that represent that sea change. And this is the challenge of the day, and it's a challenge that I'm optimistic will be met under this administration. And I'm optimistic about that because I see a marked, and I know this has been discussed earlier today, I see a marked continuity between the last administration and this administration in relation to the vast majority of policies and programs that have been implemented since 9/11. While there are certainly a few areas of serious disagreement, there are many more areas of agreement. And when you think about it, that continuity is really not all that surprising. Not all that surprising given that most of these policies really aren't that controversial to begin with in the eyes of most Americans. Secondly, it's not surprising given the fact, as has been remarked in the press recently, that there really is not that much daylight between the national security perspective of this administration and that which held sway in the last years of the Bush administration. Also, given the fact that we had a smooth presidential transition process that allowed for meaningful sharing and mutual understanding of the origins and purposes of the existing counterterrorism policies. And finally, it's not surprising, given the fact that historically there have not been and there should not be wild swings in national security policies between administrations. There's a need for policy stability, and the perception of policy stability, especially when dealing in the international realm. And I believe that this administration, like those in the past, is demonstrating a keen appreciation for that concern. So given that we have a level of continuity in the executive branch on most issues, what should happen at this point to institutionalize and establish our nation's counterterrorism program? In short, we need to identify those issues that are still unresolved, and then Congress needs to step up and take ownership of those issues. If we want to confer complete and lasting legitimacy on our counterterrorism policies, we need to bring the current debate into the legislative realm and hash it out in the context of concrete proposals and legislative line drawing. And I've been involved in two such exercises over the past 4 years. One, the debate over the renewal of the Patriot Act, and then secondly, the extended deliberations over the amendment to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which resulted in the FISA Amendments Act of 2008. And though both of those processes were long and drawn out, and especially in the in terms of the FISA debate, I felt like I was basically living on Capitol Hill giving briefings and testifying. The reality is those debates represented the democratic process at work with some of the most difficult issues of our time. Strong views were held and strong views were expressed. Members worked hard to develop an understanding of the relevant areas of law and operations. And virtually every facet of those two pieces of legislation was subject to rigorous scrutiny and debate. And the result of that process was strong legislation that provided the government with the tools that we needed, along with sufficient safeguards to make sure that we use those tools responsibly. And the upshot of that whole process was to put to rest, to basically put to rest the controversy that had previously swirled around each of those areas of the law. The Patriot Act, that had been publicly demonized by many, pretty much became a non-issue with the passage of the Patriot Act reauthorization. And the issue of wiretapping overseas persons without a specific warrant, which had prompted the creation of the terrorist surveillance program and triggered the ensuing controversy, was largely mooted by the FISA Amendments Act that laid out a workable framework for doing those operations and passed Congress with a broad bipartisan consensus. I'd like to see Congress undertake the same process with the issues we're currently facing. First, Congress needs to address the detention issue that I know you discussed here today. Just as Congress calmed the waters in the Patriot Act area and with FISA, Congress needs to work with the President to craft an enduring legal structure for detaining terrorist suspects in this asymmetric conflict with international terrorism. Second, Congress should act promptly to make the three counterterrorism authorities that are going to expire this year or sunset this year, to make them permanent. And those are the roving wiretap authority in national security cases, the ability to get FISA authority against a foreign terrorist whom you cannot connect to a particular foreign power, and then the business records provision of FISA. Those have all proven to be invaluable tools in the efforts against terrorism. They're subject to careful scrutiny and oversight, and they should be made permanent. Third, Congress needs to be involved in the decision how to prosecute the detainees in Guantanamo, as well as those detainees we're inevitably going to continue to confront and bring into custody around the world. As you discussed earlier today, one option is to create a national security court that's designed to handle these cases with special rules that address the particular challenges that arise from cases that grow out of intelligence operations and military operations, issues such as how to protect classified information and how to deal with hearsay rule requirements as they apply to evidence that's collected out in the field. Another option is to bring those cases into the Article III courts. And in that case, that's the way it's going to go. Congress should consider whether and how the current rules that obtain in our criminal justice system can and should be adapted to meet the needs of these cases. For example, whether the Classified Information Procedures Act, CIPA, should be amended to provide greater protections for the highly sensitive intelligence and information that necessarily is going to be implicated by those cases. Those are tough issues. I'm not minimizing how difficult an issue like that is to wrestle with, to take long-standing criminal rules that have obtained in our criminal justice system and adapt them for a new set of cases. They're tough issues, but there's no better time to address them than now. And that is because right now is when we have both political branches, the executive branch and Congress, looking for a means of prosecuting these cases or some number of these cases in our criminal courts. So now is the time when the interests are aligned. They should look at those hard issues and try to resolve them. So those are just some of the areas that the government needs, where the government needs new authorities and a legislative framework for prosecuting its counterterrorism efforts. Other needs are sure to arise in the future as our adversaries adapt to our security measures, as technological change opens new opportunities for our adversaries, and as intelligence tells us more about our potential vulnerabilities. And I'd urge the administration to be forward-leaning in seeking new authorities to meet our operational needs. We've seen the consequences of waiting too long to seek the authorities that our operators need. We waited too long to dismantle the wall between our law enforcement personnel and our intelligence personnel, and that wall handicapped our coordination tremendously, and we didn't do so until after that handicap was laid bare by the unsuccessful efforts to find the 9/11 hijackers in the days leading up to the attacks. We also waited too long to address the problems that technological change caused to our FISA operations. Those problems were plaguing our FISA operations before 9/11, and it wasn't until spring of 2007 that we proposed a legislative fix, and it wasn't until summer of 2008 that we actually got that legislative fix. So if and when the administration identifies operational needs, it should not wait and Congress should not balk at considering how to meet those needs. And if the administration can make the case that it needs a particular authority and that that authority can be implemented in accordance with law and the Constitution, the question for Congress should not be whether to provide that authority, but how to provide it with sufficient limitations and oversight to ensure its responsible use. The executive branch learned in the course of the Patriot Act reauthorization debate and in the course of the FISA amendments debate that we could live with oversight. And in fact, the passage of the FISA Amendments Act is due in large part to the executive branch's willingness to accept substantial congressional and judicial oversight in our FISA operations. It was sometimes cumbersome and often frustrating for those of us who had to, you know, go through that oversight, go through the exercise of it. The comfort that that oversight gives to Congress and the American people is often what makes a difference between passage and non-passage of national security legislation, and is a small price to pay for an effective counterterrorism authority. So those are my wishes, sort of my wish list for the near future of counterterrorism law and policy, that we acknowledge the fairly broad consensus and areas of agreement about our counterterrorism program, that we develop possible solutions to address those unresolved areas, and that Congress take those issues up and address them with sound and deliberate legislative processes. If we do that, my hope and expectation is that the issues that seem so divisive today will go the way of the Patriot Act debate and the fear over a warrantless surveillance and become the hot button issues of the past. Thanks very much for having me, and best of luck.
Thank you, Ken. Are there any questions for Ken? We may have a minute or two if anybody has a question. If not, let me thank everybody for coming. Ken, thank you for your remarks. Thank you for your time. Thanks to the Heritage Foundation for co-sponsoring. Thanks to Vince Witkowski of the Federal Society of International Law and National Security Group for helping plan this. And thank you all, of course, for attending. We are adjourned. Thanks.